Welcome to Under Lock and Key, news and commentary about prisons from the Revolutionary Anti-Imperialist League. The U.S. incarcerates a greater percentage of its population than any other country, sending more black men to prison than to college. The purpose of this program is to educate about and inspire activism against the American lockdown.
This week, our special guest is Ben, whose pen pal was Freddie Lee Webb, Jr., who was legally murdered by the state of Texas on March 31st, 1994. Ben, how did you first become involved in the struggle against the death penalty?
Well, in 1991, I was reading a copy of Progressive magazine sometime in spring, found a listing for an alternative periodicals index, which cost $2 to purchase. I sent in the $2, got the index. There were lots of different magazines, newspapers listed amongst them was something called Endeavors, and I sent with a self-addressed stamped envelope and got a copy of their paper, written strictly by death row prisoners, artwork done by death row prisoners, funding for the paper and assistance with printing, etc., done by nuns and certain people from outside. And in the paper was a pen pal bank. It asked you to send in a letter addressing yourself, some of your interests. They would hook you up with an individual. And in July of 1991, I received my first letter from this person, Freddie Lee Webb, Jr., and that's what basically sparked the whole odyssey.
Can we talk a little bit about who is on death row and who's not? There's a perception that death row is reserved for the most horrible of murderers, particularly gruesome serial killers.
Through my experience and correspondence with Fred, I learned that, as they say, that capital punishment is for those that don't have the capital. I remember a Newsweek article sometime in 1992 about Jeffrey Dahmer, and the fundamental purpose of an article such as that with in Newsweek is to give the general public that impression that everyone who is on death row is someone of that caliber, a completely deranged, psychotic individual, when in fact the death row system is made up predominantly of minorities, many of whom who have been in a one-time incident, drug-related, alcohol-related, perhaps. In the case of my own pen pal, Fred, I came to learn through correspondence with him again that his situation was that he was in the wrong place at the wrong time, basically, and refused to name names, and his penance was to stay on death row.
In 1996, after the Oklahoma City bombing, Congress passed the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act. This law makes it more difficult for death row prisoners to appeal their sentences. Freddie Lee Webb, Jr. was executed before this draconian law was passed. But if appeals are difficult now, I thought your story about Fred's efforts could put this new law into context.
I know that at the time that I met him in 1991, he had already experienced three stays of execution, and during the course of the time of our letter correspondence, which consisted of July 91 till his execution in March of 94, he had four more stays of execution. I remember writing to him and asking him any way, shape, or form that I could help, whether it be through some sort of letter-writing campaign, whatever. And it was a very tricky thing because I found when it came to any questions to him about that subject and specifically why he was in there, his response to me was often quite cryptographic. And a little over a year into our writing, in just one paragraph in a letter, he said to me, and couldn't kill anyone. And why should he lie to me? There's no reason. I started writing to him with the impression that he had killed someone, was there just to be a friend of his and someone to write for him to write to and to be consoled by and be a friend with. But when I heard this, you know, just a lot of things started going off in my head, and I wanted so badly to help him, but I came to learn that he was playing cat and mouse with the district attorney, that things that I wanted to do or that I thought would be useful or helpful could ironically backfire, which is why he was very careful about saying things to me concerning his actual case in letters, because he didn't want his mail to be read on the way out and anything that he said to come back to haunt him at a later time.
Well, I know one time in 1992 you were approaching various activists in this area, asking them for money for a specific, there's a specific thing that Fred needed help with, and I thought maybe you could talk about that.
Well, he was just trying to raise money to get his own legal defense if he could, because he had been dealing through court-appointed lawyers, anything the state would give to him, and most of those people, at best, were useless. They were just basically bureaucratic clowns, and at worst, they were harmful to his case. As far as they were concerned, he was just another black on death row. There was really nothing that he had to say or could say that was going to be of any help. He was just another statistic. But so I was accustomed to, you know, trying to help him out in any way I could financially. And at one point in time, he asked me if I could try to raise some money so that he could get his own legal defense. And I got a few people to help me out. But I realized that it was going to take more than just money for that to happen, because there was no way that he could do this on his own. For one thing, obviously, he's in Ellis One at Huntsville, and he's been there at the point that I met him. He had been there for almost 5 years, so he was very restricted to that degree. And as I said before, I think there were a lot of people within the legal system in Texas who saw that he was a pretty bright fellow. He was doing his own legal work, and that was really a threat to them. You know, that someone actually might have enough intelligence in that situation to want to try to help themselves. So there was really little he could do except want to have outside legal defense. So I started making some calls with his suggestions, because I mentioned previously, there was no way that I wanted to do something or anything, even with the best of intentions, that was somehow going to backfire. Because you know, the last thing that I wanted to do was anything that was going to harm this individual, especially if I did something even with good intent. And I came to learn quite rapidly through writing to him that I was dealing with an incredibly twisted, labyrinthian, and very insidious system. So he gave me names and numbers of a few people that might be advisable to call, and I made the calls, basically got the runaround, was extremely persistent with these people, and unfortunately the physical distance between us didn't help matters. You know, I was working full-time at that time and living in Massachusetts while he is, of course, in Texas, so my own time was restricted in order to be able to do anything at that kind of long range. A couple people that I knew helped me out, but our hands were tied. There was so much I could do, and then it was just the rest of it was just left to just hoping and trying to have a little bit of faith that these people would listen, which generally they didn't do. I sent a letter, or more actually, I sent a bunch of letters to Ann Richards, trying to be as diplomatic as possible. I remember being at
the governor of Texas at the time.
She at that time was the governor of Texas, and I tried to be as diplomatic in writing to her as I could, just to sort of take away my own, for the moment, larger political contextual views of the death penalty, and to just plead with this woman and say, look, you know, I know I can't change everything.